All right. Before we dive into the math, I thought I'd show you an example from a talk I found online that demonstrates the phenomenon of Mi scattering resonances, which you can... Why do I keep losing what I want to show? And basically, if you have nanoparticles, they could be spherical, or they're, in some cases, there's been study like by the Schatz group at Northwestern, who's a famous physical chemist, theorist at Northwestern University. You come in with, let's say, a white light source, and you look at the scattered radiation from the nanoparticles, which is basically what's going on here. You've dissolved the suspended the nanoparticles, usually of a conducting material. They're made some kind of gold or silver in a liquid. Then you look at the scattered light coming out, which is what we're going to calculate today, show how to do that exactly. You find there are some frequencies that are resonant. And so like the absorption or the scattering cross-section versus frequency will have some pattern of resonances, which basically usually mean the light is absorbed at these resonances, and what's left tells the color of the material. The frequencies that are not absorbed in the metallic nanoparticles. So here, I think they've just changed the size of like nanospheres in the material, and you see different colors in the scattering. It's kind of a cool phenomenon. Basically, to describe this, it's really not perturbative, because what's going on is that there are waves that have resonances, and then the photon, let's say if you think of in the photon picture, photon comes in and stays, has a long time delay in the nanoparticle before it comes out. And at these resonances, it stays a very long time compared to just going in and coming immediately out. Okay, Mi scattering resonances. You've heard of them?
No.
Okay. You ought to look it up. It's a really cool phenomenon. And this is an experimental example. Okay, let's do the math. Come on. Yes. Okay, so the topic of this lecture is, like I say, basically it's an exact way to treat the scattering theory. And especially for spherical objects, it's especially convenient the way I'm setting it up today. Making use of the spherical symmetry, we have an incoming plane wave, which is not very spherical, but we have outgoing spherical waves, which are very spherical, and we'll have to do wave mechanical carpentry to assemble these waves in a consistent fashion. So let me remind you, in scalar scattering theory, like what you would normally learn in your quantum courses, it's much simpler, unfortunately or fortunately, than what we'll do today, since we're going to do vector scattering theory, transverse vector fields. The key formula which is usually the starting point of a derivation of Schrodinger waves for a spinless particle in quantum mechanics off of a spherical center, is the plane wave expansion. This occurs, the spherical plane wave expansion. You need this for basically any kind of scattering you might want to do, whether you are scattering sound waves off of an object or Schrodinger waves. Pick your favorite waves. You need this formula, which is how a plane wave coming in can be decomposed into spherical eigenfunctions of the Helmholtz equation. Which is this infinite sum. You have 4 pi, sum from L from 0 to infinity, I to the L. Our old friend, the spherical Bessel function, the one regular at the origin, argument kr, times the sum from m minus L to L, ylm star, of the vector direction, unit vector of the incident plane wave, k hat, times the vector x hat, the unit vector in the x direction. So we'll need an analog of this expansion for vector transverse vector field. Which will be a little more complicated, but it has the same basic underlying mathematical structure. And so for E and M, we'll consider an incident circularly polarized field of either helicity we could describe, once we have that formula for the two circular polarizations, we could describe any polarization. Before I forget. We have E for positive or negative helicity, electric field. Now this x hat is different from the x hat in my YLM because this is really a Cartesian x hat. You just have to know what I mean, even when what I write is self-contradictory. Let's pick a plane wave coming in on the z-axis, the photon incidence direction, which I guessed in the notes I labeled A, and then the magnetic field, or magnetic induction, I should say, is z hat cross E, which is minus or plus I times E plus or minus of x. Right? Since z hat cross x hat plus or minus I y hat will be y hat minus or plus I x hat, which we can write minus or plus x hat plus or minus I y hat. And that second one I've called equation B. So we need the analog of this formula, but for the vector, keeping track of the vector directions and such. And basically, we can write these fields in spherical coordinates relative to some scattering center. We're going to place our origin at the center of our scatterer and make use of the spherical symmetry of the scatterer. Of course, this will work best if we have a sphere. Then we will have basically in the end scattering phase shifts is what we're going to calculate for the TM mode and the TE mode. If it's not spherical, we would find like a diatomic molecule oriented or something like that. You can apply the same theory, but then you'll get a not just simply phase shifts, you'll have a scattering matrix. Maybe for TE, for instance, which will scatter you from an incident partial wave L into a different partial wave L prime if you have non-spherical symmetry in your scatterer. But we're going to focus on the simple geometry of spherical scattering and show how you can characterize exactly the scattering amplitude, scattering cross-section, the angular distribution, the polarization, everything in terms of phase shifts, which will depend on the nature of the index of refraction and so on of the scattering spherical object. Okay, so we have the spherical expansions of these two equations. Let's write the first, E plus or minus of x. Now, expanding our vector plane wave, it should, right, we can always expand in terms of the complete set of orthonormal multiple solutions that we've derived earlier. And so I'll write it that way for now to start. Just a general way we could write any vector field as some constants, which we don't know yet, which could be different for the plus and minus case, different plus or minus circular polarization. We'll have a JL of KR. Remember, we're just describing the plane wave, and the plane wave is in a volume that includes the origin, so it can't involve any of the other Bessel functions that are divergent at the origin. Our old friend, the spherical harmonic with J equals L, which following Jackson, we called this XLM. And then there is the second type that would involve a second set of constants, BLM plus or minus times the curl of JL of KR and an XLM of theta phi. And a similar expansion for the magnetic induction, CB plus or minus X. This is a sum for L and M of the same A and B, you recall, will also appear in the magnetic induction expansion because these obey Maxwell's equations. In regions with no sources, minus I over K, ALM, plus or minus. And now we have a curl term for the ALM in the magnetic induction of JL, XLM. And then we have BLM, plus or minus multiplying JL of KR XLM. And I guess I called in the notes equation A prime and B prime, in case I need to refer to these later, which I think I will. Okay, so we know we can expand these vector fields in A and B this way, but we don't yet know the coefficients of the expansion. Here's how we find them. Just using, well, it's basically applying what Griffiths calls Fourier's trick and using the orthonormality properties of these angular functions. Okay, so let me sketch how that goes to find the ALM, BLM, and there are three key orthonormality relations, which I'll remind you about, that we've, I guess, encountered them before. Number one is the integral of any radial function FL prime of R XL prime M prime conjugate dotted into a vector with an arbitrary radial function GL of R XLM integrated over all solid angles will equal FL prime GL Kronecker delta in L and in M. I better start a little further left. The next one is the integral of FL prime of R XL prime M prime conjugate dotted into the curl type term, curl of GL of R XLM d omega is always zero. Kind of makes sense because the curl implies these have different parity. Okay, and the third type we need is a little more complicated orthonormality formula, 1 over k squared, the integral of the two curl type functions, del cross FL prime of R XLM conjugate dotted into the curl of GL of R XLM integral over all solid angles. It's a little more complicated because we'll have radial derivatives floating around for these radial functions. It still has a Kronecker delta part, delta LL prime, delta MM prime, but now the radial stuff tacks along FL star GL plus 1 over K squared R squared D by DR of R FL star times d by dr of rgl. Okay, so what we're going to do, I think you can imagine, we're going to take equation A, which I've partially erased, this one, this line, equate it to equation A prime to A, multiply by XLM, and integrate d omega. And I'll spare you some of that algebra. It tells us that ALM plus or minus JL of KR is equal to the integral of XLM conjugate dotted into this formula for E plus or minus. D omega. And so we can get the constant itself by dividing, of course, both sides of the equation by JL of KR. This angular integral has to come out to be proportional to JL of KR. Otherwise, this equation makes no sense. But it will. If we didn't make a mistake, don't forget, if you ever go through derivations like this and you find that your constants are not constants, you should go back and check your work. Because constants should be constants. One of the more profound things I've ever said in my life. The other one, JL of KR, is equal to C times the integral of XLM conjugate dotted into the magnetic induction of the two helicities plus or minus d omega. This is all a, of course, we haven't really solved anything about our spherical scattering object yet. This is all a preliminary. We have to be able to characterize our incident plane waves in spherical coordinates in order to do that step and match to boundary conditions later. So this is all sort of a mathematical preliminary. How to write the incident plane waves spherically. Okay, some other identities. Note that XLM conjugate dotted into E plus or minus vex is equal to LX minus or plus ILY. This, by the way, is our quantum lowering and raising operator, except for the H bar has been left out. This acting on a YLM of R hat, or I guess I wrote it as R hat now instead of X hat. I'll be a little inconsistent in my notation. Over root LL plus 1 conjugate times this quantity, 4 pi sum over L and M I to the L JL of KR YLM conjugate of Z hat for the incident wave vector, and then YLM of R hat for our outgoing spherical waves. And the reason it's useful to write it this way is to remember the formula from quantum mechanics. We all learn that L minus or plus, acting on a YLM, theta phi, remember it doesn't change L, but it lowers or raises M with a constant. And that constant is L plus or minus M times L minus or plus M plus 1 to the 1/2 YL M minus or plus 1. Which you should have all learned in your quantum courses long ago. So using that, we can apply it and that's here and then going to be integrated over. Yeah. That's right. So that's basically writing this part of that dot product. Okay. So in the end, all this algebra gives these coefficients for the incident plane wave in the spherical representation, which we're going to need to know later. The ALM plus or minus equals I to the L and 4 pi 2L plus 1 to the 1/2 Kronecker delta M plus or minus 1. And the BLM plus or minus works out to be minus or plus simply I ALM plus or minus. All of this is for monochromatic waves, of course, an incident monochromatic plane wave. We've now got a formula for it in spherical coordinates. And I guess you'll feel cheated if I don't write it. So let me write it. We have these two beautiful formulas now. Our electromagnetic plane wave E plus or minus is X hat plus or minus I Y hat E to the I K Z is equal to a sum. The lowest L actually starts at 1 instead of 0 because it's a vector. And we have an I to the L, 4 pi 2L plus 1 to the 1/2. And we have a JL XL plus or minus 1. Components only. The sum over M reduces just to these two values. And then that's plus or minus 1 over K curl of JL XL plus or minus 1. I think I wanted that. Okay. And then the magnetic induction times C, speed of light, will be minus or plus E plus or minus. So it'll be the same right-hand side, except with the Sorry, there's an I here, minus or plus I times E plus or minus. So it'll all be the same, except it'll have the minus I, and it will change this to minus or plus here. It's in the notes. I'm not going to maybe rewrite the B formula. Okay. So I think we are ready to do the wave mechanical carpentry. Solve for a spherical scattered wave from a dielectric sphere. So, spherical scattering is just section 10.4. We have a sphere of radius A. We have an incident plane wave coming in along our z-axis. It's going to send out spherical waves that we want to characterize. Depending on the nature of what happens inside this sphere, you might find the angular distribution peaked in certain directions. Also, you can find that at certain frequencies, you might have resonances, resonant absorption. And what do we expect, basically? The E and B fields for such a problem will look like throughout space. I claim they should look. We have linear Maxwell's equation. So we should have something like the total E field at any position should be, we can write it as an incident E field plus a scattered E field that would not be there if there were no scatterer. So the scatterer is going to cause an extra term at any point in space to be there. And similarly, B will have a scattered term as well. And one point of physics in the math that it will only make sense if we think in a sort of a causal way, that if a wave comes in and strikes a localized scatterer, these should only have outgoing wave parts at infinity, the scattered wave. I saw a quizzical puppy dog look. I mean, the waves go out, right? These have a time dependence, U minus I omega t. If we had an e to the minus ikr over r at large r, we only can have these two, right? These are our outgoing Hankel and incoming Hankel functions. This with e to the minus I omega t would be a wave coming inward, right? And this is a wave going outward. So we only can have that at infinity in the scattered wave. On the other hand, our incident plane wave, it has both in it, right? A JL, for instance, at large R is a sine wave, sine kr minus L pi over 2 at large R. It has both when you write the plane wave in spherical coordinates, it has both an outgoing wave part and an incoming wave part, which kind of makes sense, right? Here, the wave is kind of incoming. Here, the wave is outgoing. So that's one way to think of it. The plane wave has both. Okay, so let's write what our spherical Hankel functions have to look like once you're outside the scatterer and you're just solving the free space Maxwell's equations. Well, I just gave away the secret. They have to involve radial functions that are outgoing wave Hankel functions. So, in other words, we'll have only HL1 of KR present, and our full scattered wave then must look outside like I don't remember why the 1/2 was introduced, but it's there, so I'll write it. Has to look like I to the L 4 pi 2L plus 1 to the 1/2 some unknown constant alpha L, which will be different in principle for the two helicities, times the Hankel function, argument KR of course, and XL M equal plus or minus 1, plus or minus beta L plus or minus another constant we don't know yet, over K times the curl of the Hankel function times XL M equals plus or minus 1. Okay, so we know we should be able to characterize our outgoing spherical waves this way. Similar expression for the magnetic induction, C B scattered, so 1/2 sum over L equals 1 to infinity, I to the L, 4 pi 2L plus 1, 1/2, minus I alpha L plus or minus the same constants, but now over K, a curl term of HL1 XL M is plus or minus 1, minus or plus I beta L plus or minus HL of 1 XL plus or minus 1. Right. You might wonder why the M value has to be the same, this plus or minus 1, as in the incident plane wave, and that's basically a statement of the spherical symmetry of the problem and of the boundary conditions, which are also cylindrically symmetric about the z-axis, right? So if you, again, had some really weird shaped scatterer that did not have spherical symmetry, you might need to be summing over. I guess that's not true. We know these waves have plus or minus 1. Yeah, I don't think that's true. We know that the waves at infinity have to just have the plus or minus 1 because those are the solutions of the free field Maxwell equations. But you could have a different, more complicated sum over L if you don't have spherical symmetry in your scatterer. But anyway, we're doing the spherical case. Let's focus on that, which is simplest. And if you want, you can generalize to a non-spherical scatterer in your vast spare time. Okay, so how do we find those constants? Once we find alpha and beta, we will have described the full scattering. And how do we do that? Basically, there are a couple of different scenarios. For instance, if we know the nature of the solution at the sphere surface, like if it's a conductor, say a perfect conductor, right, then we wouldn't actually solve for the solution inside the metallic sphere. It would be kind of, the fields will be trivially zero there. Then we would represent the nature of this scatterer by boundary conditions. And we would match some appropriate boundary conditions at the sphere surface. That's how we would find the alpha and beta. Second scenario is like if we had a dielectric sphere, then we might have to solve for the actual solution, spherical solutions inside the sphere. And match at the sphere surface to those expressions there. And then those formulas will take us to infinity, where the detectors live, presumably. Okay, so we'll tackle this in basically two steps. First, and I'm thinking a little bit really more of the second scenario here, where we have a dielectric sphere, we're going to first solve for complete set of TE and TM modes inside the sphere. And there we will impose boundary conditions only at the origin. R equals zero, and not at infinity. The infinity boundary conditions, in a sense, have already been imposed in these forms outside the sphere. But inside the sphere, we'll have regularity at the origin as our main boundary condition. And then the second step is we'll find we have to superpose the solutions to to match scattering, physical scattering boundary conditions. So those are our two steps. And in particular, in that second step, we will be demanding something. That the asymptotic form of our scattered wave solution, actually of our full solution, I should say, not just the scattered wave, the full solution needs to look, as r goes to infinity, like our incident polarization vector E naught, little e naught, times the plane wave, plus a scattering amplitude that only depends on the angles of the incident wave vector and the incident polarization vector, and has an outgoing spherical wave behavior at infinity e to the ikr over r. So here at this point, we're going to have to actually, we will initially find terms like this that we will have to cancel out in our algebra when we first do this. That's the strategy we have to go through. And of course, a similar expression for the magnetic induction. Okay, so let's make this concrete, tackle a very specific problem. Let's do a dielectric sphere with linear media and homogeneous within the sphere. Okay. So it'll have radius A and linear media constants throughout the sphere of epsilon and mu. And we'll see how it scatters. So what we're going to do is we're going to separate space into an inside region, which I'll call region 1, where we have an epsilon, we have a mu, we have a k prime, and an outside region 2, where we have epsilon naught, mu naught, and an incident wave number k. And I'll need to remind you of a few things that we have to keep track of, a few relationships, I epsilon omega E plus the curl of H is 0 minus I mu omega H plus the curl of E is 0. K prime is omega root mu epsilon. K is omega root mu naught epsilon naught. And so K prime over K is mu epsilon over mu naught epsilon naught to the 1/2. Okay, keep all that in mind. Okay, now for step one, we're going to ignore the scattering boundary conditions. We're just going to solve four Maxwell's equations inside the sphere. And write the most general solution that could exist inside the sphere. Okay. R less than A. So we'll have TE and we'll have TM solutions. I'll just write the individual modes solutions. ELM in region 1 for the TE modes, we know is a JL of K prime R XLM. Right? It has to be JL only, since this domain includes the origin. If we had a problem like with, I don't know, a hollow sphere, then in the domain, in this region, you wouldn't have the origin. You would need a linear combination of JL and NL. Okay, but anyway, we're doing the homogeneous complete solid sphere. So we can only have JL. H for the TE modes. In region 1, V1 over I mu omega curl of JL of K prime R XLM. And the TM modes, we'll start and write H first for those. HLM for the TM modes in region 1 are also JL of K prime R XLM, and E corresponding E for the TM modes are minus 1 over I epsilon omega, and a curl of JL of K prime R XLM. All right. Now, if we have these solutions for a TM and a TE mode inside, we can take those outside the sphere by just matching also to a spherical solution outside. So in region 2, we're going to have basically the identical expressions with only a few differences. So at R greater than A, the solutions that connect to the ones inside will have the same forms, except for two differences. First, we'll have to replace epsilon by epsilon naught. Outside, we'll replace mu by mu naught, and we'll replace k prime by k in the outside solution. And the second key step is that our solutions must include both spherical Bessel functions. We'll must include the two linearly independent spherical Bessel functions. I could pick any two, but I'm going to pick the two real ones, JL of KR and NL of KR, which is sometimes in the literature written YL of KR. So we'll have the same kind of formula, except we'll have a combination of two spherical solutions everywhere that in region one we just had a JL. Then we'll have to match boundary conditions at the surface of the sphere, these region one and two solutions. Okay. And if you know your quantum scattering theory, and you were scattering like from a spherical square well or something, you'd have the same thing. You'd have a JL of KR inside a spherical square well, or with a K prime R, and you'd have a JL of KR plus NL of KR outside. Okay, so let me remind you our boundary conditions we're going to need to obey at the surface. We're going to have, we have no surface charge. So D dot R, the normal component of D at the sphere surface, is continuous. B dot R, the normal component of B, of course, is always continuous. We have third boundary condition, the parallel components at the surface of E have to be continuous. And since we don't think there are any surface currents, we haven't specified any, that is, the parallel components of H are continuous also. Okay, so let's write our solution, let's say for the TE mode, right outside the sphere. Okay, ELM in region 2 for a TE mode. Now, I claim, must have this form, ALM TE JL of KR plus BLM TE NL of KR times our XLM angular vector spherical harmonic. And continuity of E parallel implies, right, that at R equals A has to equal that. And so we have JL of K prime A must equal ALM TE JL of KA plus BLM TE NL of KA. One equation and two unknowns. And now the continuity of D perpendicular is irrelevant for a TE mode. So let's consider the H parallel boundary condition. HLM of, in region 2, TE, right, is 1 over I mu naught omega curl of ALM TE JL of KR plus BLMTE NL of KR times an XLM. That's going to be equated to this at the surface. And then we will have two equations and two unknowns that'll tell us our constants. To do that algebra, an identity is kind of useful. N hat cross curl of ZL XLM where ZL means ZL of KR is not just an arbitrary radial function at this point, it's any solution of the spherical Bessel equation in this identity, n cross curl of ZL XLM is K over 2L plus 1 L ZL plus 1 minus L plus 1 ZL minus 1 XLM. Nice little identity. Bessel solution. And because this combination is going to appear when we match this H, I'm going to introduce a simplified notation. And I'm going to call UL of X defined to be this combination for the regular spherical Bessel solution, L plus 1 JL minus 1 of X minus L JL plus 1 of X. And a second solution, VL of X, defined to be L plus 1 NL minus 1 of X minus L NL plus 1 of X. This will allow us to write the matching boundary conditions a little simpler. And so then in particular, this H continuity equation, where I equate this to the now erased H in region 1, reads for H parallel continuity equation, we'll have K prime over I mu omega UL of K prime A has to equal K over I mu naught omega outside ALMTE times UL of KA plus BLMTE VL of KA. Okay, so this plus this, we have our two equations and two unknowns. And we'll just write the solution of those two equations and two unknowns without torturing you with the algebra. It's convenient to define another constant, gamma, which is the ratio of K prime mu naught over K mu. And then we'll have ALTE is KA squared over 2L plus 1, JL of K prime A, VL of KA minus gamma, UL of K prime A, NL of KA. That's A. We're getting close. And BL, again, just for the TE modes, is KA squared for 2L plus 1 minus JL of K prime A, UL of KA plus gamma UL of K prime A, JL of KA. And in the notes, I pointed out an identity, which I might as well point out here as well. NL times UL minus JL. This is all for the same argument, Z. I've written it times VL of Z is minus 2L plus 1. Over z squared. Those of you who know Wronskians might think these are a little bit analogous to Wronskian relations. But if you don't know about Wronskians, never mind. Okay. At this point, we're going to introduce the idea of scattering phase shifts. We have these nice formulas as a linear combination with constants AL and BL of our two independent solutions, JL and NL. Okay. But it turns out that only their ratio is needed to understand the scattering. And to reflect that in our solution, which I won't really probably have time to prove till next time why that's true, but it's useful to recast these two constants, A and B, in terms of a phase shift that is related to their ratio. So in particular, we will set AL for our TE mode as an amplitude, which we won't end up caring very much about, times the cosine of a phase shift, really, which will be different for the TE and the TM modes. And we will set the other constant to be that same amplitude, but with a minus sign and a sine wave, sine function of the corresponding phase shift. So that, in other words, the tangent of this phase shift tells us the ratio of B to A, or actually it's negative. And now let me show you the reason we introduce that. It's because the JL And the NL look at infinity like sine and cosine. And by introducing this phase shift, it just simply shifts the phase, appears in the solution as a shifted phase of the outgoing wave for that L. Do I have time to do this? I think so, this step. Okay, so it's done because this means our ALTE times our outer solution JL of KR plus BLTE NL of KR. It means with this transformation I introduced to capital A and delta, it allows me to write the solution as the overall amplitude over KR times sine of KR minus L pi halves plus the phase shift. The phase shift combines the two regular and irregular solution to make this simple change in the phase of the outgoing Bessel function from what it is in JL will become shifted. Okay, it looks like a very mathematical thing, but the thing is this phase shift we'll see next time tells us everything we need to know about the scattering. It's kind of amazing. A bunch of real numbers. And usually if we're in long wavelengths, or at least not too short, there will only be a finite number of these that are important. So it's a really beautiful theory. I really think it's a nice development, and we will finish it off next time. Anyway, if you haven't done your quantum scattering yet, you might read ahead in your books and see how this idea shows up of scattering phase shifts in the quantum scattering problems. Okay, see you on Wednesday. Don't forget there is homework due on Wednesday. Just one short problem.